Our sun, ultimate source of all the energy concentrated and stored in the fossil fuels that man is rapidly consuming. The sun, that incredible power source that provides the energy to support all life on Earth without pollution. Actually, the star we call the sun is a giant thermonuclear power plant, constantly converting hydrogen into helium and releasing vast quantities of energy, heat, and light in the process. The Earth receives less than a billionth of the total energy produced by the sun because, much to our benefit, the power plant is 93 million miles away. Consider that on a bright, sunny day, the amount of energy falling on a housetop from the sun is 100 times greater than the electrical energy being consumed by that household. The radiant energy from the sun striking the Earth is only a tiny fraction of that which emanates from it. The sun uses, in only seconds, more energy than human beings have consumed in all of history. Or consider this fact: if all the Earth's fossil fuels combined with all the world's forests could somehow be piled together in one giant heap and ignited, the resultant energy released would equal what falls on the Earth and the sun in only 3 or 4 days. That's how powerful sunlight is. But what is the answer to the looming energy crisis? The developing countries of the world are way behind in their consumption of the world's fossil fuel reserves. But we in the Western world, along with Western Europe and Japan, are fast approaching a gigantic energy crisis. And the brownouts, the blackouts, and the interruptions of service, the power failures, and waiting in line longer for some of the services required in our energy crisis, the threat over fuel shortages, the idea that maybe natural gas is not going to be around another 10 years from now, all of this just now beginning to crop up in our Western world press. But we are in the midst of a very important energy crisis. The question is, when will the lights all finally go out for good? The energy crisis is not sensationalized news media attempts to sell papers. It's real. It's here, right now. It affects the United States and many big cities, summer, winter, and fall. This summer, no doubt, with the increased consumption of electrical energy in many of the big sprawling megalopolises as our summer heat waves come along, or during the winter, when the freezes come along and people are heating their homes at a prodigious rate, or when some of the large public school buildings can't be operated because of dwindling energy sources such as the fuel oils or coal that stoke some of these ovens and heating systems in some of the bigger buildings of ours, then and only then does the Mr. John Q. citizen feel the immediate crunch of the energy crisis. Most housewives aren't frustrated or thwarted when they walk into the kitchen and punch about a dozen different buttons to start these energy slaves in action that we appreciate and we enjoy every single day in our modern technological world. But when and if one of those buttons doesn't work, or when all the lights go off and then they run to find out, does the telephone still work, and they call the police department as if the police department is supposed to do something when the lights go out. Actually, when people experience earthquakes, and who they call? The police. Do guys in the police department wear boots that big? I mean, people call the police when the lights go out, when the water isn't running, when there's some sort of a crisis of some description that might have to do with a brownout or a blackout in a big city, as if the police department is to blame. Actually, no one seems to know who to blame. The guy down the street. Whoever it was, the last guy that got up and turned on the electricity in his house that so overburdened the system that it all failed, he's the guy to blame. Why the energy crisis? Who is really to blame? Could the energy crisis have been averted, and can it be in the future? The government, the environmentalists, the power companies, and the public all have their favorite scapegoats. The government claims the environmentalists have blocked development of more energy sources. For an example, oil wells or nuclear power plants, or the squabble over the new developed or developing fields up in the Brooks Range and north of there in Alaska, and the Trans-Alaskan pipeline. So the government claims that environmentalists are the ones that are blocking the future energy sources and their development. And the power companies have been more interested in a fast profit than in long-range planning. The power companies counter that the government has caused the problem by oil quotas, by restrictive laws, and so on, and the environmentalists have put up one roadblock after another to prevent the power companies from meeting the burgeoning demand for more energy. The environmentalists, on the other hand, charge that the power companies and the public are at fault because they have no regard for the ecological impact of high energy consumption, and they claim the government has failed to put proper restrictions on unbridled growth without taking into account some of the environment. The public, on the other hand, complains that the power companies, the government, and the environmentalists have all contributed to the fuel shortages, power blackouts, and rising energy costs. The public thinks that other segments of the public are guilty, and oftentimes the public simply fails to understand. When I attended Governor Reagan's California conference in Los Angeles on the changing environment of the state of California, I listened to officials of the Southern California Edison Company talk about, be it ever so humble, there is no place. Meaning, when it came time with these sprawling urban complexes and suburban complexes and redevelopment high-rise apartments in the old slum areas, with all of the crush of these additional millions of human beings in our sprawling cities of today, when it came time to provide all the power for these modern, marvelous electrical homes, these cocoons of ours that are heated, that are chilled or cooled, that are lighted, in which we cook and we live with all these energy slaves powered basically by electricity or by gas or what have you, be it ever so humble, there is no place, they said. No place for what? Well, for that great big ugly plant they've got to build that belches all those clouds of fossil fuel smoke into the air. Or if it's a thermonuclear plant, nobody wants that thing even in their own county, let alone in their backyard. Now, how many people want to look out their kitchen window as they twist the faucet or punch the button or hit the lever over there and hear the whirring and the buzzing of all these energy slaves and see the source from which that power comes? It's an ugly source. It's a stream of never-ending huge coal cars or oil cars going into the blackened maw of some back entrance to an ugly old kind of a factory-looking thing. And there are these giant boilers and all these engines and all these electrical lines running everywhere and these smokestacks just belching all the effluent up into the air, and then the empty coal cars going back and forth, the ugly parking lot and all the fencing and all these ugly funny-shaped buildings. Nobody wants to see the source of where all that stuff comes from. We just want to use the energy. And so the power companies are sort of frustrated because they say the people are screaming more. It's an insatiable maw out here, the public appetite for energy slaves. More! We want more of all of these things. But yet, when the power companies say, well, we're trying to give you better service, madam, she says in a pig's eye and hangs up on it, and they're thrust, you know, into a situation where they can't find the acreage, be it near the beach, somewhere out in the suburban counties of the Los Angeles area, maybe in Orange County or somewhere else in San Bernardino County. Or people have said, why don't you take it to the high deserts? And then the environmentalists begin to scream. So they, at that time, pointed out the very real difficulties that there are, and the pulling and the tugging between the government, the power companies themselves, the environmentalists, and various segments of the general public. And so really, everybody is to blame. You and I are. I am, you know. You are. We all are. And yet, nobody's to blame. It's just one of those things. Earl L. Butz, who was Secretary of Agriculture, stated, and I quote, "The first people to have their power shut off should be those who blocked the Alaska pipeline." And so, the controversy rages.
200,000 miles of high-tension transmission lines dramatize the Plain Truth article on the energy crisis. This feature story, which appeared early last year, is available in reprint form. What's Behind the Energy Crisis? Also, request a free subscription to The Plain Truth, the world's unique news magazine. Without anything to sell, The Plain Truth points to a happier life through sharing, helping, and serving. The only possible solution to produce peace between nations and individuals. Now published in five languages and read by more than 5 million people around the world, The Plain Truth can be yours every month without any obligation. Be sure to request What's Behind the Energy Crisis and The Plain Truth Magazine. Write Ambassador College, Box 111, Pasadena, California. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, BC.
There are two extremes in the picture of the user of energy sources these days. One is the hippie type who rejects the establishment with its high energy demands and its toys. As a matter of fact, this television set into which you look is called one of the toys of the establishment. The cameras and the videotape recorders that are whirring away in there with the electrical energy being consumed, the lights that you have to use, these are all toys. Sometimes the extremism of this hippie syndrome, that's a kind of a coined word, the rejection of the establishment can go to the freakish far out point that people feel you shouldn't use any energy. I don't know whether these guys are starting fires with rubbing sticks together, but that's using energy. But they have the idea that we should live in a kind of a pure, pristine state. Actually, some of the hippie communes you see out here in the wilderness look more like a pig pen than they do a pure, pristine state. At the other end of this ironic extreme is the modern energy guzzler with two or three automobiles, maybe a camper, a power boat, and all sorts of power tools, from lawn mowers to power tools in a garage, and all sorts of electrical gadgets to do his bidding, kind of like the modern Roman there that is utilizing servants and with his giant chariot with the sweating four horses there. So whatever it is, at either extreme, there are all kinds of ideas about energy, about light and heat and motion and power, the ability to do work, where it all comes from, the storage in our Earth's crust of these fossil fuels that ultimately all came from the sun. Yes, even coal, because actually what caused the plants to grow, what put all that carbon there, the carboniferous deposits of the shale and the coal strata in which oil and all the coal might be found, all of this ultimately came from our sun. It's stored energy, but there's only so much of it. And as I've shown in the short series of programs on the energy crisis, it's a giant geopolitical power struggle these days and an economic struggle for the big powers of the Soviet Union, Western Europe developing into a giant economic bloc and eventually a military bloc, the United States dwindling in power in the midst of a monetary crisis, deep internal social, economic, racial, spiritual problems, and an emerging, burgeoning giant of Japan buying up long-term preferential trade agreements and securing various options on energy sources in Central and South America, in Africa, North Africa, and the Middle East. So the energy crisis is a global problem and not just a Mrs. Household problem or an elevator getting stuck or a subway train that refuses to run or an electric toothbrush that needs a new battery. The idea that science and technology should remove all work from our lives seems to be a modern American notion. In most technological societies, this is a phenomenon that begins to occur. The idea that every possible physical task should be performed by merely touching a button. That to get up and walk, or to work, or to go through the abominable physiological process, a kind of a disgusting biological process of letting a little bit of perspiration come out of one's skin. You got this spray can, you're running around, there's a drop, you know, get that real quick. And you just someday hope that they'll figure one for the right side, so you wouldn't have to stink on one side and smell good on the other, whatever it is. But these guys are leaping around, I feel dry. You know, I really couldn't care less what the guy's sweatband on his shorts feels like to him, whether or not he's leaping around, I feel dry. Well, honey, I don't care whether you're dry or wet, you know, I just don't even want to hear about it. I mean, babies get wet, but you don't like to hear about people walking around and say, well, it's another subject. But we have these gadgets to convey our bodies, our flatulent, flabby bodies, from place to place. Carried to its ultimate extreme, I guess you could take high-rise apartment living. And you walk. Unfortunately, I don't think they've found a way to convey you, unless they've got little golf carts parked on the floors these days of the 20th floor of a high-rise apartment. You walk to the elevator. Of course, you push lots of buttons. Everything has been pretty much automatically done for you in the morning, and the biggest exercise one gets in the morning is maybe if one does take a shower or bend over to tie one's shoes. Then you walk to the elevator, and it carries you down. And then you walk to a car, and your body is put in the car, and it's taken to a building where you get on an escalator and go up a couple of floors or into an elevator, and then you're moved up into another building and then down the corridor ways, and there you are. And you've probably walked less than one city block in many occasions, such as this, as I depict right now in some of our big cities, our honeycombs, like people living like ants or bees in our big cities, in order to go to what is called work. And then the work is done with a dictating machine or sitting at a desk with all sorts of energy slaves there. And the same process is repeated in the evening. And we have everything convenient to the automobile to drive into this and that. Theaters, movies, banks, believe it or not, even drive-in funeral parlors. And automobiles themselves are filled with all sorts of energy slaves. There's just one thing about the automobile that's rather strange. Now, you've got all these energy slaves in there. You can reach down here and you can push a little button and your seat goes all kinds of directions. Or maybe it goes all the way and folds back and you can lie down. They got power brakes, power steering, and power drive, and you punch a button and the little thing on the windshield squirts and the windshield wipers engage. Everything is electrical. There's only one thing on the automobile that doesn't work anymore. You see, they have these anti-smog devices now. And that causes something to happen with your automatic choke, your carburetor, and this anti-smog device, which is really weird. Do you remember what it was like way back years ago when you would push on the accelerator of your car and it would go? I remember way back, I had a car when I could push on that accelerator and, boy, the car would go, you know. It was really a great feeling. Now I just push on the accelerator and it just sort of sits there and makes a noise. It balks a little bit, kind of lurches around, chokes to a stop, and I got to start it a couple more times. Well, they're telling me in these huge one-page ads that the automobile companies claim they just cannot comply with these anti-smog requirements of the federal government. And Mr. Ruckelshaus arguments and this and that. The Japanese companies now, they claim they can. The Mazda goes, and the other one goes, boing, boing. The Mazda company and some of the others, Honda, I believe it is, claim that they could easily comply with that, but we can't. Well, maybe that's another subject, but yet it's not really another subject, because one of the greatest energy slaves of all time and one of the most voracious consumers of energy sources is the infernal, we should call it maybe, combustion engine in America's big, hulking, snorting, 300-and-a-quarter horsepower automobiles that don't go anywhere very fast except to join the traffic jam and then just kind of sit there. But believe it or not, the energy crisis is coming upon us because of a total false sense of values. We have not taken time to find out why we are on this earth, what this world that we're a part of is all about. This narrow little limited biosphere in which we human beings live and work, we stand right at the absolute middle of the biosphere. It extends away from us in both directions, from the shallow waters of the sea, down into the depths of the sea, and from the air we breathe where it's thickest, right at sea level, and where most people work and live, down within a couple of thousand feet above sea level, and then it gets less and less, including growing things, trees, flora, fauna, and the air to breathe the further we go up. So just a very narrow little blanket we call the biosphere, and in it, and conveniently close to hand, all sorts of energy sources compacted and put into this earth for our use. It's going to be a very strange thing for us to uncover at some time in the future. The fact that mankind had come to the end of his allotted human experience for his own self-attempts at governing himself contrary to his God, thumbing his nose at his God, rejecting God's laws, rejecting the explanation of a creator God, rejecting the idea that the ultimate energy source of all the universe is God, and yet man is going to find that he's about to run out of everything that was compacted in this world as an energy source at the end of an allotted 6,000 years, and ironically, he's going to find these energy sources running out at about the same time that he gets into the potential for nuclear extinction in an all-out end-time war. And Bible prophecy has a great deal to say about that.
The richest, most powerful group of nations on earth, the United States and British Commonwealth, are part of one of the most mysterious puzzles of all time. The prophecies of the Bible mention such small nations as Libya, Syria, and Ethiopia, but they seem to omit all reference to our peoples. How could such important nations be left out of inspired prophecy? This mysterious puzzle is unraveled in the full-length book, The United States and British Commonwealth in Prophecy. This book reveals the true identity of our peoples from the pages of your Bible. And yet it goes beyond past history and shows you what to expect in the future. For your free copy of The United States and British Commonwealth in Prophecy, write Ambassador College, Box 111, Pasadena, California. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, B.C.
Who are we? What are we? Why are we on the earth? What is this world of ours? What is energy? What is heat? What is light? Where does it come from? Who put the sun up there? How was the energy stored? What is electricity? We really can't answer some of those questions. We can see what electricity does. We know we need it to produce energy and to do work for us, but its ultimate source? I mean, what causes lightning? What makes the thunder roll in those clouds? Meteorologists aren't even sure of that. They're not really quite sure. It's still an area of speculation. And the way electricity acts, some of the amazing things that happen in electrical storms are still not really fathomed by human minds. Now, in this short series of programs on energy usage and a modern-day energy crisis, I don't have time out to go wading clear back through all the evolutionary biases and prejudices, all the evolutionary dogma that is just like faith in some oriental religion, a belief that random miscreated order. I've done this time and again. I think we had something like 26 programs in a row where we took all of these yawning chasms of missing information, and we showed that evolution doesn't have a chain. It's got a link here and a link there, and about 200,000 yards of all the rest of the links are completely missing. So you write for the booklets that we have on that, the tale of a whale and a story for the birds and some fishy stories about evolution. That's another subject. But the point I want to make is that this earth of ours, on which we find all these minerals, this fossil storage of fuel sources, is like a clock. It's just as much like this watch I've got on. I have to wind this thing, and I find myself doing it subconsciously. Get up in the morning, first thing you do, you tend to wind your watch. This is not one of those automatics, so I have to wind it. Well, our world is much like that. It's like a clock that is running down, even as erosion tends to lower the mountains and raise the bottoms of the seas, the lakes, and the like. So the energy sources gradually dwindle, and no new non-renewable energy resources are being put inside the soil at this time. You know, God's Word tells us that physical man was only meant to dwell on this earth in a physical state for approximately 7,000 years. Now, I believe the world may be 4.5 billion years old. If they want to say 8 billion or 10 billion, that's fine. The Bible allows for that. That doesn't go contrary to God's Word. The world could be 14 billion years of age according to what the Bible would allow, because the Bible doesn't set that kind of a date. But the Bible does show there is a purpose and a plan of God, and that man was going to be on this earth to learn those lessons and to come to that final great climactic day when Jesus Christ of Nazareth would come to this earth again and rule it with a rod of iron. And it's rather interesting to note that at the same time we stand in peril of a deadly nuclear bomb cataclysm, where all of humankind could be annihilated, all of these other curves, the curves of the population explosion, of global pollution, and the specter of approaching famine, and now of the dwindling energy sources, the non-renewable energy resources in the earth, and the crisis in energy, that all these things tend to head toward our time, the end time, the day in which we live, and that the energy crisis is a very real thing. Actually, the Bible shows that there is going to come a time when there are cataclysms unparalleled in the history of humankind. And the interesting thing to note is that even scientists these days tend to tell us more and more we're nearing the end time. They don't put it in biblical language, but they say these fuel reserves are dwindling, and soon there won't be any more. And the day will come when they simply are gone. Interesting, isn't it, how all those things seem to fit together. Now, there are some physical things we could do. Even in obeying God's laws, we could reduce our waste in using fossil fuels. Quickly, let me tell you just a few of them. One, we could improve building construction. That's a vast subject, but we could tremendously lower the energy usages by simple construction methods of better insulation and of utilizing different materials instead of thin little paper mache walls to kind of heat and air condition all this, if we had greater insulation and complete different construction ethics, a complete different code. Improving air conditioning efficiencies, we could do this and make it far better. And that's a subject I'd like to harangue on one of these days. Maybe I could come back and ad lib a program on these very same ideas right here and just kind of kick it around, because air conditioning is a favorite hang-up of mine and probably of yours, because we live in an air-conditioned world. Increasing trees and shrubbery around houses is quite an idea. Maybe we should discuss at some greater length. Reducing air and automobile travel and increasing rail travel is something the big cities are going to have to face sooner or later, or else the strangulation of traffic and the simple inability to move, which in a sense is an energy crisis as well as a traffic crisis, is going to become unbearable. But that's something that ought to be thought of too. During the 60s, passenger traffic on U.S. railroads decreased by half, while automobile mileage increased by 50%, and airline mileage increased almost threefold. Yet for intercity passenger transport, the automobile requires 17% more energy and the airplane 190% more energy than the train per passenger mile. And for freight transport, the comparison is even more striking. Truck transport requires almost 5 times more energy and airplane transport over 61 times more energy than train transport per ton mile. We could improve the efficiency of energy use in industry, and we could minimize energy conversion. Well, we have articles coming along in the Plain Truth magazine on this energy crisis, and its economic, geopolitical, and its personal concern on all levels. You ought to get your name on a mailing list of this unique magazine. It's absolutely free of charge. There is no price for it whatsoever. We have timely articles in depth every single month on the exact same type of issues I discuss on this simulcast, which goes over television to about 65 or more channels in the United States and Canada, sometimes Sunday only, and many places daily, or on daily radio in countries all over the earth. For those of you hearing the soundtrack only, you're only getting the radio soundtrack of a videotape that we have done in the Pasadena studios. But the Plain Truth magazine will get... Oops, the lights went out. I knew it was going to happen, an energy crisis in our own studio, and I... There we go. We were prepared. We were prepared for this. We thought that someday it might happen. And sure enough, just as I was telling you about this beautiful Plain Truth magazine, all of the lights looked like they were going to leave us forever. So we prepared the TV studio like our homes have to be prepared, you see, with a candle. Now, I keep candles around in drawers of the house. I notice that when I go in federal buildings and other places, I see a little battery box up there somewhere with a light in it. And there's an automatic switch that is thrown. When all the main lights go off, why, that little battery box comes on, and then you get auxiliary light. Well, we're not that modern here in this television studio. We decided to use a candle. What about that final day when all the lights go out?
You have seen Garner Ted Armstrong. Send your letters to Ambassador College, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Or Post Office Box 44, Vancouver, BC.